you.
What about this one for my nephew?
A superb choice.
Oh, great.
You provided he has already read Infinite Crisis and 52 and is familiar with the reestablishment of the DC multiverse.
Who am I, Cypher? The gayest X-Man?
I recently read this novel called Watchmen. I've never read a comic book like this. I used to read Betty comics, but that's it. I've never read, like, real comic books. This worked my out.
Excellent!
Hello, hello, hello. This is Chris and Eric's Songbox Adventure.
I'm Chris.
And I am Eric. This is our final episode of season two, as it were, before our anniversary special. And this week we are diving into Western comics once again, maybe Western horror. We will talk about the marketing and the execution of that genre bending here as we get into it. But the topic at hand is going to be Desperados: Quiet of the Grave. Desperados is a series of various Western minis from the late 90s through the early 2000s, published by Homage Comics, which was an imprint of Wildstorm, which then, of course, got bought up by DC. And Desperados as a whole is written by writer Jeff Marriott, with this series having pencils by the late, great John Severin, whose work we discussed last year with his time on The Rawhide Kid. In addition to those two, we have colorist Nick Bell with assists from Wildstorm FX. And letterers credited, we have Jenna Garcia, Gus Hartman, and Ryan Klein. The specific miniseries came out in 2001. And I'm reading from the trade paperback. Chris has the floppies. There's not really much of any difference, I think, other than just the trade has a little intro and outro added to it, like a text introduction and afterward, I mean. And I'll probably quote those a little bit at points just to sort of talk about the genre marketing of it all. But I guess just to give a brief gist of what this is about before we dive in. The titular Desperados are a group of friendly outlaws with hearts of gold. We have Gideon Brood, who is the main character of all the main characters. He is appropriately brooding, tired of all of the trouble he keeps encountering in the West. Jerome Alexander Betts is a bit of a competent smartass who his main character arc here is basically going to involve getting the hots for a barmaid named Maria. We have Abby DeGrazia is the sole woman of the main characters. And then there is Race Kennedy, who has a flame for Abby, who has a flame for Gideon, who does not have one for her. And essentially, at the beginning of the story, they are all just trying to take some time to rest and relax in a town just by the Mexican border after whatever shenanigans from the prior Desperados comics. And things quickly go off the rails. There is a young man, probably not more than like 16 or so, named Jimmy Miggs, who sees Gideon Brood's wanted poster and attempts to take him down for the reward money. Gideon tries to tell him to back off, but ends up having no choice but to shoot Jimmy in self-defense. Jimmy is killed. And after this point, Gideon essentially rides off. He's tired of all the trouble, does not want to keep roping everyone else in on the trouble. It just keeps following him. He ends up having a plot line running into another outlaw named Clay Parkhurst. They have a whole thing to do with Parkhurst stealing what's basically a magic amulet sort of thing from a nearby Native American tribe. So they get a bunch of trouble dealing with that. Meanwhile, Jimmy Miggs's father and son, or rather, Jimmy Miggs's father and brother, I should say, Tom Miggs, the father, and then the surviving son, Gil, start to set up a plan to try and get revenge upon Gideon for the death of their brother and son, respectively. And in the midst of all of this, the dead Jimmy Miggs's body goes missing. He ends up returning towards the end as a zombie. There's a whole shootout prior to that with the Miggs and some people they recruit of trying to get the revenge for the kid's death. Maria gets kidnapped. Just, you know, the gang gets split up dealing with all sorts of different threats of just everyone wanting revenge for one thing or another, with things ultimately culminating in them getting back together and having to deal with the arrival of Jimmy as the zombie, and Jimmy essentially having been resurrected by way of Brujeria. The character is just referred to as the Brujo, as in Brujeria, which I had to Google, and appears to essentially be a term for Latin American witchcraft with roots in indigenous African and European witchcraft traditions. And yeah, we'll talk about the ending with the zombie and how things sort of wrap up, or rather don't wrap up. Character-wise, Race Kennedy gets got, and Clay Parkhurst takes his place as the fourth man in the Desperados, and they all just sort of take a minute to mourn their friend before assumedly going off into the sunset to have the next miniseries adventures. But yeah, that's Desperados, Quiet of the Grave. Where would you like to start?
Let's just start with John Severin, because I think that's certainly, for me, is the place where I have the most just unbridled positivity, because I think the art looks great, much as when we covered Rawhide Kid and Severin's art there. I think this is fantastic. This might actually be even better than Rawhide Kid in terms of just, like, on the level of his art.
I agree, yeah.
His characters are really expressive. He absolutely, like, he doesn't just dodge what's one face syndrome. He, like, flies away from it at all speed. Everybody has this really distinctive set of facial features. The horses, when we see them, there's a few less horses in this than I think they were in Rawhide Kid, except for scenes where there's a lot of horses. The horses all look fucking great. The, like, layouts are always, like, easy to read. He never does anything especially complicated with them, but, like, it always works. It's very solid storytelling, and the figure work is just fantastic. It's so good.
I agree, yeah. That's a great point about the faces, especially. It's the sort of thing that can be, like, sometimes easy to not think about unless it is poorly done, or unless, you know, the same face syndrome is there. Like, I don't think I had even really consciously thought about it until you pointed it out. But yeah, they are really well done in terms of everyone having different facial structures. There were never any clarity issues for me in terms of like who was talking or any other sort of, you know, visual issues that could arise. The general just like clarity of visual storytelling is great. On the topic of faces, I think my favorite has to be Gil Miggs, the dumber brother of the dead boy. How did you like those gap-toothed ass, like, what's the name of the mascot of Mad Magazine?
Oh, God. The What Me Worry thing? I do not know. There was a time in my life where I probably would have known, but that time has long since passed.
But yeah, just like the several teeth knocked out. Alfred E. Newman. The name is Alfred E. Newman. But just like, he is just the archetype of dumb, bumbling white trash, you know. Or he has the comedy of the father just like constantly hitting him upside the head, you know, talking about how much dumber he was than his brother, et cetera, et cetera. But to go back to the art, I love the horses. Like you said, always love a Severin horse. I think that there's some really well-used splash pages and two-page spreads in terms of just like page composition, the perspective in general throughout. I frequently found myself thinking about and just how impressed I was by it in terms of just like these pages that convey pretty wide distances as we see like one party getting chased from afar by another, and just like how well the various distances and locations of different figures in a scene were conveyed, I really liked. I also really like the coloring. I think Nick Bell does a really good job of doing work that is complementary to Severin's style. And yeah, it looks great.
Yeah, the coloring is like not quite flat, but there's minimal in like gradients, which I think is just right. Like, it's this really good balance of more modern techniques, but like working with the classical way that Severin is penciling this.
Yeah, with Severin's style being as line heavy and detail heavy as it is, I think that this coloring style really helps to like make it look good without risking ending up like being too busy or clashing. What did you make of the characters?
They were fine. Like, none of them I found annoying, or like, I did not enjoy reading this comic, if that makes sense. Like, this is definitely not bad. But, and now admittedly, I missed a miniseries and a one-shot that these characters had had previously, and maybe if I'd read those, I'd be more attached to them specifically. But I didn't especially care about any of them either. Like, I think in terms of the, like, archetypes that have been assembled for this story, you know, you've got your, there's the gruff older guy who's really tired of all the killing and the Western stuff that he's had to do. You know, you've got the go-get-em, you know, she's the girl that can shoot the gun in the Western. The, like, upper class, you know, he's come to the frontier and is surprised by it character. And then Betts, who aside from liking Maria, I can't figure out exactly, like, what his deal is, to be honest. There's an implication, like, which Betts is African-American. And, like, there's an implication of him facing racism at points in the story, but, like, that it's not dug into. Same with Maria, actually, because Maria is from Mexico, and they both, like, there's a little bit of that, but it's not a major theme of the story, and it's not, like, a huge driver in their plot together either. It's just that those two characters are tied together. I think they're all fine. Yeah, I mean, it's a 5-issue mini, and most of them got something to do that was not uninteresting. I think it might have been stronger if they hadn't all been split up to the degree that they were. Like, I think that the stuff where Abby and Race, right? I'm getting my names correct, aren't I?
Race Kennedy.
Yes. Yeah, where Abby and Race get separated together, I thought that was pretty strong. Where they go after Gid after he, like, leaves town spontaneously. And they wind up, like, spending the night together. And despite the fact that they're worried about dying for a first, wind up fucking, which, okay, not a thing I would think about when I'm already thirsty. But, you know, go for it, guys.
Yeah.
Life and death situation, sure, but also, like, the thing that you're doing is going to make you more thirsty. Just saying.
Yeah.
But, I mean, other than that, there wasn't anything I especially, like, was drawn to. I was just like, yeah, this is the take I have on this series where I'm like, yeah, mostly it's fine. Mostly it's like a Western comic, and I've never been, I'm not a Western guy. So whenever I read a Western, I'm waiting for something else to come along.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
I do think it was a perfectly good example of a Western set of characters. Better than a lot, frankly.
Yeah. I'm not, like, really historically a Western person either, but I've slowly started to read a little more here and there. You know, Rawhide Kid is the gateway drug, essentially. But I agree with regards to the characters. I think that they're well written. I think that for only being 5 issues long, I think the book does a good job of juggling as large of a cast of main and supporting characters as it does. You know, I would agree that Jerome gets sort of the least definition of the main group. I also think that Clay Parkhurst's character arc doesn't really fully work for me, and that it doesn't really feel like it's fully there. You know, we get the, like, him holding Brood at gunpoint to suddenly signing up to join the rest of the group at the very end and seemingly act in a bit less of a shithead way, which doesn't really feel fully, I don't know, what's the word, earned, explained. I don't really buy it, you know, I guess, but I like the drama of just the various, like, minor characters and antagonists with regards to their revenge plots. You know, I felt like I had a good sense of who most of the characters were. I think the other main exception beyond the couple I sort of talked about would be the Brujo, the Native American magician who essentially does the, like, zombification magic. We get a few really brief, like, one page scenes of him, but for someone who has such a critical role in the goings on, I don't really feel like I got much of a taste of who that character really is. You know,
you say a critical role in goings on, but if you cut the zombie subplot, there is exactly one thing you would need to change to give this comic the exact same ending that it already has.
Yeah. I guess, should we just, shall we talk then, I guess, about the sort of horror bent and our expectations of that, I guess, of, like, expectation versus reality? Because I know when I told you this was a horror Western, what you got was not what you were expecting.
I thought I'd see Severin drawing some blood and guts. I was like, okay, I'm kind of excited to, because like the Severin that I've read is just the Rawhide Kid series, which is very much like in a comedic bent. And this, weirdly tonally in terms of the art, felt really similar to me. And I was waiting for the horror to happen, and it just sort of doesn't. Like, there is a zombie, but I shit you not, the moment the zombie meets the main characters to the zombie being dead and gone is exactly 2 pages. And this isn't even them, like, they've not been looking for the zombie. They don't know about the zombie. This is the first time these people see the zombie. And then 2 pages later, the zombie is gone. And this zombie is of the kid that get, like, killed at the start of the story. And we don't actually have a panel of him reacting to it, which is odd.
That's a good point, yeah. Like, of all the characters to have a major reaction, there's really none. There's like the idea of a zombie, you know, is horror. And there are like a few images or ideas raised throughout that like have the stuff of horror, but they're either executed too briefly or off panel, etc., to really feel like they are tapped into, you know, to sort of sell terror or dread or unease. Like, at one point earlier, there is mention of a husband whose wife dies and he has her body taxidermied, you know, which that's a horrific concept, doesn't show up on panel. You know, we get on panel really briefly when the zombie shows up in town. We get like it holding a gun, but not holding a gun directly, because it's holding a gun inside of an arm that it just fully ripped off of its last victim, you know? So it's this dead Western figure waving around a gun-wielding detached arm, you know, which that's a fun horror image idea. But again, very swift, very quick. In terms of like the zombification even, there's not really a depiction of that ritual that really builds up dread or anticipation or anything like that. You know, the zombie just sort of strolls on in at the very end. And given that we've seen it like get shot before and then seemingly regenerate, at the end of the comic, I was like, well, is it dead? Because I'm not convinced that these shots would have killed it any differently. Oh. But the zombie's gone.
So oh, what wait, happens?
But there's like the Brujo like does something.
Yeah, yeah. So he gets monkey's pawed. Right? Like at the end of the monkey's paw, the short story, the parents who like wish their kid back to life, but the kids come back as this like horrific zombie that's beating on their door. You know, they undo the wish and he just disappears. Like, it's not like they open the door and there's the dead body. It's the mother demanding that the Brujo like undoes it, and then he waves around I think that's a skeleton arm and a bit of rope or something. Like it's we're very far away from it in the panel, so it's just some shapes that he's holding. And like, based on the coloration and the way that Severin's like reducing the amount of line work to more like dashed lines forming outlines rather than like filling in the line of the shape, I think he's fading away.
Honestly, I think this is probably the weakest executed scene of the book for me. And like, just to be clear, everything you just described is the literal second last page of the comic. We have literally a page for the come down from the end of the final fight.
Cut the zombie, have Race get shot by someone in the shootout, and then you've got 3 pages of wind down. Like 3 extra pages to wind down the story and just finish off the little bits and pieces. And the book is actually stronger because then you can also take the like 4 or 5 pages of zombie things from before this and just use that for something else. Yeah, and on the subject of like the sort of horror elements, the mystical stuff feeling out of place, the amulet thing from the Apache tribe that Clay Parkhurst has literally fucking grave robbed, which basically, in terms of the plot of this story at least, serves solely to make Gideon go, oh, my friends are like over there.
Because he like gets the visions from touching it.
Yeah, so he like knows where Abby and Race are and is able to save them from dying of thirst because he's like, we're 100 feet away from this creek, you dum-dums. Which I think you could have achieved by pointing out that Abby and Race had a fire lit, which would make them visible from a distance. So the like, maybe that's set up for something from a later miniseries, but in terms of this, I also think the amulet is just not necessary.
Yeah, like, it feels like something competing for page time that could have been the core conceit of a different story.
We have like a multi-page origin story for this magical amulet that makes you see visions. And I mean, its function in story doesn't do anything. It's like evil because of a mad shaman, like killed people to make it. And then when you touch it, it gives you visions that drive you insane. Unless you are Gideon when he touches it. Because he only touches it like a little bit, so it just gives him visions that like upset him quite a bit.
We get like the panel of, oh, there's just like part of his glove is frayed off, so it's just like a portion of a finger.
Yeah, and he gets a vision of, he mentions that he has a dead wife, so I think like one of them is him finding his dead wife from the past. The other is that, you know, Race is dead, which happens at the end of this comic. And then there's another of what looks like him facing down a bunch of guns, which could be from the end of this comic. Or maybe that's how he dies in, like, a future Desperados miniseries. I obviously don't know. But, like, if that's it, I feel like this is another thing where, like, you could cut it and then you could make Clay, like, not a man who robs graves from, like, a colonized people and make me really dislike the guy if he's apparently going to join the crew at the end of the comic. You could have found something that's, like, a little less severe for him to have done. The way that, like, most of these other characters are, like, not that bad.
Like, his team up with Gideon is so circumstantial, because at first it seems like he's about to kill him, and the only reason he's even given Gideon his gun back is because they're being chased, and he's just, like, weighing his chances. So going from that to not only him not stabbing Gideon in the back, but essentially replacing Race and the group after Race died, I don't see any character motivation for it. You know, like, if it was a heel turn that came about for his own advantage, you know, of insincere reasons, we're not even really shown that or like given interiority for the character to sort of get at that. It just really feels wholly unexplained, unearned to me.
Agreed. And, like, there's no moment I like Gideon less than when he looks at a bunch of Apache warriors chasing this guy down and is like, I'm gonna be on the white guy's side because I don't like an unfair fight. Like, he acknowledges, oh, he's done something to piss them off, clearly, and I'm like, yeah, they could be entirely justified in doing this. Which, yeah, they are. He fucking grave robbed. Like, I'm fairly certain there's several Apache characters who just, like, wind up dead because they are, quite rightly, going after this asshole.
Gideon even has, like, a thought bubble or, like, a narrative caption or something like that about, like, hoping that none of the Apache chasing after this guy are the ones who have recently helped him and that he feels like he owes. And yet he still is like, okay, I'm going to help this stranger. I'm going to just put myself into this conflict where I don't know if the intention was for him to be close enough distance-wise that he would inevitably be drawn in, but it doesn't really feel fully like he was in enough danger to even have to make a split-second decision, really.
He sees it hiding behind some rocks. He could have stayed hidden behind the rocks.
Yeah.
He could have, like, ridden in and just been like, hey, what's going... Like, if he has to get involved, why is it just, like, jumping out from behind a rock and shooting at the Apache chasing the guy? Why isn't it just going in between them and being, like, grabbing him and being like, all right, let's just sort this out here and now, peaceably. Like, I am here, you're not allowed to kill this guy, but let's figure out what's happened. Or, like, it's a weird bit of plot that I didn't like. And the amulet stuff that it leads to, I don't think adds anything. All the strongest aspects of this book are the ones that are just regular Western plots and not where we're heading into supernatural elements, which is a bit of a shame for something that's sold on, like, horror Western.
Yeah. He even, like, follows Clay into this secluded area and, like, thinks to himself, I hate places like this. It's really secluded and there's only one exit and that's dangerous. And he does it anyway. And then Clay pulls his gun on him. You know, it's like, oh, this seems like a bad idea. And then it was a bad idea, you know, which, like, not to do the cliche of complaining about people acting illogically in horror movies, but, like, I'm not really sold that it makes sense for this character to be doing this, you know? Like, I'm not really sold that Brood would do this, you know what I mean? Because, like, part of his whole thing is being the, like, gruff, broody, but, like, competent at what he does.
Yeah, like, he reads normally as an intelligent character. It's not like in horror movies, it's normally a state of panic that causes people to make the dumb decisions. But he's not, like, scared. He's rationally thinking through, this is a bad idea to do this. Anyway, I'm gonna do it. Like, he could have just left. He could be like, I helped the guy get away. I gave him a solid, it's up to him now to do the rest or whatever. And he could have just gone. But he keeps re-involving himself in Clay's business for no reason. And it just screws him over on multiple points. He gets to touch a magic amulet that tries to drive him insane. He gets shot at repeatedly. And, like, a Native American tribe that he had up until now apparently had friendly relations with may just be after him now. Like, what if one of the guys who he knew was there and recognized him? Maybe now his name is fucking Mud with them. That seems like a really dumb thing to do. It's just strange. It is notable for me how the inclusion of these supernatural elements really drives the last two issues down, and the first three are definitely the strongest because they are pretty much purely a regular Western where the storytelling by and large does really work for me. Even though, again, I'm not a Western person. I just like John Severin's art.
I distinctly remember the first time I read this, as I started it and like read like the first half, I loved it, but then fell less into the second half. And I had like read it in two sittings, and part of me was like, is it the fact that like I didn't read it all at once? Did I fuck up my momentum somehow? But I feel like this ending is rushed. And then reading it again today, I read it all in one sitting, and I basically arrived at the same conclusions as the first time I read it, and basically mirroring, you know, a lot of what you've said today of, for me too, like, I preferred the first half to two thirds and thought there was some really strong stuff in there. Of course, John Severin being the strongest aspect, I think, here, because it's John Severin, you know, and him being on it is the entire reason that I ever looked at the book and was like, oh, I'm going to read this, you know. And in terms of his art, I certainly was not disappointed. But I guess in terms of discussing the horror stuff, I'm going to go ahead and read a portion of the afterword from the trade edition written by Jeff Marriott. Empty places sing to me, the vast windswept deserts, stark mountains, deep forests, wretched swamps, any of those places that on a map are not covered with those annoying dots indicating towns, cities, and concentrations of people. Most of America's empty places are in the West, so I have been drawn to that region as a place to live and a place about which to write. Empty places, of course, can also be horrifying. You're on your own out there, cut adrift from the safety nets of population and society. Places where few people have traveled, and even fewer choose to stay, hoard their mysteries, keeping them fresh for future consumption. And both the intro and the outro and the trade dress, you know, make a lot of the horror aspect of the story and the genre mixing. And they like sort of talk about that in terms of like comics is a medium where genres can be mixed. And they sort of like talk about their feelings of audience expectations and publishers' expectations across like the publication industry, et cetera, et cetera. And with regards to like the quote I just read, you know, it's a great explanation of how like a Western setting can be an effective setting for horror, you know, the isolation aspect of it in particular, the sort of physical geographic isolation and extremity, you know, even if materially it's sort of visually the opposite of, say, like an at-sea story, it sort of mimics that sort of, here are humans removed from their usual context, like much closer to all the dangers of nature with that much less protection, that many fewer allies, et cetera, et cetera. You know, man versus nature. You know, the intro and outro really talk up and make me go, yeah, I want a good horror Western, you know, like that just makes sense. Like when you put it that way, it becomes a perfectly natural like pair of genres that could be easy to meld. But I think that neither of us really feel like this specific book pulled that off, even though that was their intention, which I guess I have to wonder, just like, is the main issue ultimately that they were pushing against a specified page count, you know? Like, could they only get 5 issues approved? And, like, could they have better incorporated these elements with more pages? You know, it's just kind of impossible to evaluate there because I can't judge something that isn't real. You know what I mean?
I think that if you've got 5 issues and you want to do these horror elements, they need to become part of the primary plot much sooner. Like, the main issue is the main conflict of this story for, you know, the vast majority of characters is settled at the shootout with the kid's dad and his brother and the guy whose wife Gid had, like, previously killed. You know, where Betts is able to save Maria, and, like, that's the actual climax of the story. And then there's this other thing that doesn't do anything. And, like, I think you have to drop the big shootout and make it that should be the encounter with the zombie if you want to do horror. Like, I think that they just focus too much on Western. There's too much Western, not enough horror in terms of just the way that the story was laid out within these 5 issues. I think you absolutely could have done it. Like, as much as I said, you could have just dropped the zombie from this plot entirely, you could also just drop that encounter. You know, again, I think changing the same number of previous pages throughout the story, you could change it so that, like, you dedicate all that time to expanding on the idea of this, like, necromancy happening. And, like, the idea of these gunslingers encountering a thing that cannot be stopped by their guns, I think does work as a horror beat. But unfortunately, it's they shoot him a bunch, he's still alive, and then at the end of the page, he's gone, because we only have one more page left. I just think the priorities are in the wrong place if you want to do a horror western. I think having that conflict drag out where you have, like, this creature that you cannot prevent with the weapon that you use, you know? Like, yeah, I as a fan of the Dark Tower series by Stephen King, which is also at many points a horror western fusion, I can tell you that the focus on that is still on the horror. Like, you take the western aesthetics and setting, and then you tell a horror story there. It's you don't have... The problem is the narrative structure is still of a western.
You mentioned a bit earlier about, like, the way that the group is split up to, and, like, I feel like that sort of making of two plots sort of vying for page time really hurts it. And, like, because, yeah, like, the shootout ends up feeling more consequential than the zombie. But meanwhile, it still feels like Brood is the main character, but his drama gets relegated to fewer pages. And not only that, but it really feels downplayed. Like you mentioned earlier, we don't really get him having a strong reaction to the zombie, even though it would seem to be that that should be part of, you know, his character arc and his conflict. That should be key, because it's effectively a rematch to the conflict that he had at the very beginning of the story, you know, and you could bring up whatever you wanted thematically or just in terms of, like, the character's emotional reaction and how does this situation tie in or reflect his already existent just, like, tiredness, exasperation, you know, over the lot he's been dealt and just his whole I'm so tired of it all sort of thing. And beyond all that, too, just, like, something that really cuts the horror short for me is just how much of it is off panel, which, you know, obviously there are ways to have events be really successfully dread inducing and build the pacing effectively, excitement, et cetera, in sort of a subtler or like slightly off panel sort of way. But this doesn't do that successfully because it's just sort of non-existent, you know, in many portions where it's just like choosing to not really show the birth of the zombie feels like a pretty bold choice in terms of important beats. And if you're not going to directly show it, I feel like you still have to contend with that in a way. And this just doesn't feel like it does that, you know, like on paper, like I said, like the zombie should be a major thing for Brood's character arc, but the way the situation resolves itself, it's as if it's uncoupled itself from Brood's emotional state entirely so that it's no longer really thematically relevant to anything.
Yeah. Yeah, it is strange because you would feel that, like, the zombie, you know, this resurrection of, like, this horrible sort of monstrous version of this kid that you wound up just sort of being forced to kill, but also, like, this guy's dead because of him still showing up. That should actually be the crux of the conflict of the five issues. Like, frankly, the zombie should be coming back and should be meeting Gid at, like, the opening of issue 3. I just don't think that the structure of the story and the choice of, you know, the plot lines to focus on works to have the zombie. And I'm really interested in the zombie stuff because especially, like, I like genre fusion. And I agree, I do think Westerns are a great place to do horror stuff. And I think comics are really probably better than any other medium for doing genre-bending stuff, if only because we expect that of them at this point. You know, there's too many comics with Doctor Strange and Iron Man hanging out for us to not just, like, expect comics to just have something show up sometimes that seems out of context.
The introduction talks a lot about that, yeah, about just, like, how they feel like comics and comics readers sort of allow for that more easily and expect that more easily than demands of, say, like novel markets of like adult fiction and stuff. But yeah.
Oh yeah, no, if you hand a cozy mystery reader a cozy mystery that turns out to have like some sort of zombie that comes in and kills everyone towards the end, they're not going to be happy. But if you, like, hand a comic fan a, like, and you're like, this is a mystery horror, they're going to be excited and want to read it. That's absolutely true. In terms of, like, these sort of pulpier, mass-marketed, like, audiences, yeah, the one that reads the comics is the one that wants something like this, where you're blending these two things together.
Another note, I guess just to touch on briefly, did you also feel like both instances of romance were really superfluous and like you could have done without them?
I mean, they worked as motivation for the characters to do the stuff they do in the story. But, like, I didn't get a sense of why anybody especially liked anybody else. There wasn't, like, a lot of chemistry on the ground. It also isn't the kind of comic where I expect that, though. I guess, like, I wasn't bothered by it. But I like, also didn't care about either of our sort of main couples, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I feel like, especially in the case of Race and Abby, I don't know. I feel like I'd be going too far to say that, like, it was badly done. Like, I don't think it was necessarily badly done, but I guess maybe just to go back to sort of my feeling about just like the overall page time and yeah, just not feeling fully immersed in the characters. You know, I guess I've certainly seen worse examples of, oh, suddenly the guy and the girl are into each other. But yeah, I guess I didn't really strongly feel the characters' relationships to each other in general, whether in the romantic context or other relationships, you know, because like the ending as well is like the, oh, he was such a noble, good man, and now he's dead, and we thought he was being taught by us, but he was teaching us actually, you know, that sort of thing of like honoring the friend. And it's just like, I believe that these people are close because I have been told this, but within the context of just these five issues, you know, I don't really see a lot of them being super close, which the intro, the outro also talks about like these being characters who, you know, you believe have full lives off panel, which makes me think about vintage Chris Claremont and like X-Men's friendships between characters like blossoming off panel, and suddenly Jean Grey and Storm are great friends, you know, like stuff like that. I don't necessarily dislike, you know, like the idea of like time passing that we don't see isn't a bad thing, you know, it can be executed perfectly well. I guess for me, it's just like, maybe it would have been effective if I've just got like a little more of something. But again, at this point, I guess I feel like I'm doing too much into conjecture, harping about what isn't there. On the whole, like, I like this comic, you know, for as much as we have criticized it, I do enjoy it. It's like a comic that I like and wish I could love, but just isn't quite there for the various reasons that we've talked about. It is also the sort of oddity that, you know, I want to talk about on this show in terms of multiple things of, oh, here's a genre we don't often talk about. Here is a genre fusion we don't often talk about. You know, here is a non-cape book, here is like a little niche imprint sort of thing, you know, all that sort of stuff. I think it was a fun read to do the couple times I've read it, but just sort of falls short of really fully selling what it's attempting to do.
I agree, but it does have one really important saving grace, which is why I did overall think it was perfectly fine. John Severin drew every single page of it. And as much as some of the pages, I'm like, wow, plot-wise, this needed a lot more space. Or I'm like, oh, I guess this isn't actually an important part of the story. Every page looked pretty damn good. Speaking of which, I've just looked up Severin's stuff. He drew some PPRD, so we need to cover that at some point. That's the Hellboy spinoff about the other people who work at like the supernatural FBI that Hellboy works for at the start of the series. So that'll be Mignola writing, I believe, with Severin drawing. That's gotta be great.
I'm curious to see that. Yeah,
he did Suicide Squad. Like, this is in the 2000s.
Yeah, we'll have to pick some sort of Severin to do next year to keep up our yearly Severin talk.
I may have to just go through and read all these things.
Yeah, he has an interesting career and interesting bibliography, really. Because, like, so much Western stuff like this, but then a bunch of the, like, comedy magazine like Cracked stuff, and then Yeah, just like the miscellaneous little stints on Kate books and just various titles that I never would have guessed.
BPRD strikes me as like a really good fit for Severin.
Yeah.
And honestly, like, depending on the team, Suicide Squad as well. Punisher, he did some Punisher for Marvel. That's also, like, obviously a good fit. As much as I don't like Punisher as a character, I'd read that Punisher comic.
Yeah.
What's Batlash? He worked on something called Batlash. He worked on Witchfinder. Is that the Witchfinder I'm thinking of?
No, it's
another Hellboy thing.
Too.
Okay. All right. No, that's not the Witchfinder I'm thinking of. What am I thinking of? Oh, I'm thinking of Witchblade. That's why it seemed like such a weird fit.
Yeah, I don't think I've seen him do anything like that cheesecakey.
No. Okay, well, we've got two things that he did with Mignola. He did Conan. That's also, like, that's interesting. Because that's very different from this, but I can see his style really working for it.
I believe he did lots of military stuff, too. He did some, like, EC comic-style stuff.
Yeah, that's what it's saying here. I'm just on his Wikipedia glancing through it. A long stint of inking Nick Fury and his Howling Commandos, like the original version of it, pre-Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., that also makes sense.
Yeah. I suppose now that we're on the wiki train and just
talking about Severin, yeah.
Yeah, do you have anything else on the book before we wrap up that we didn't already touch on, or are we pretty good?
Nope. That's kind of it. I mean, one more thing. There is the subtle mystery of who took the kid's body to the Brujo in the first place, because we get, like, you know, one of those shots of them with their face entirely in shadow, but we see that it's someone wearing a hat that looks exactly like the hat that Gideon wears, but also looks a lot like the hat of the kid's dad that he wears, and both of them could absolutely be that character. But then at the end of the comic, we find out that the kid's mom, who we have never seen at all in the series, just also happens to wear that exact same hat. And it turns out it was her. I don't know, I like when my mysteries are guessable, even if there's not, like, a lot of clues.
Yeah, honestly, by the time it was revealed, I had sort of forgot about it, like, just assumed it was the dad and wasn't even thinking of it as a mystery. You know, I was too busy being like, damn, this plot line is going really fast. But yeah, that's a fair point.
Well, like, Gideon's, you know, he's run away, but it's established that, like, he knows some Apache people as well. So it's like, oh, so maybe he did. Maybe this is, like, a guy he knows. Maybe. But, you know, it's not. It's just a thing that sort of just, yeah. I don't know. I thought it was weird to have it be such a mystery where I am while reading it, like, okay, which guy with a hat was it? Because it's a very distinctive hat. There's two of them in this book, and they're both people with motivation to make a zombie. But yeah.
Yeah, and, like, the mom was mentioned, like, literally just, like, once. Yeah.
Yeah, like, the mystery element's just another, like, thing added to the pot of this story where I'm like, again, all of the things that were purely just Western stuff largely worked well enough for me that with the Severin art, I was enjoying them. And then, yeah, there was just, like, I would be more annoyed by the horror stuff when actually reading the book if there was more of it, and it was just as sort of pointless as it is in this, as is. But luckily, I guess it does only take a couple pages out of the rest of the story.
Yeah. On the whole, I concur with what you said about John Severin being the artist here. Really, really elevates it. I suppose all that said, it's a fun book. We criticized it a lot, but if any of it sounds interesting, I recommend it.
It's not a waste of time.
It is, if nothing else, at least an interesting experiment or interesting crossing of genre with great art.
And maybe some of the other volumes do like the genre stuff a bit better.
I am curious to eventually try them if I ever get the chance to get them cheaply. I know John Cassidy does some of it.
Yeah, he's like the co-creator of the series, and I'm like, the Cassidy stuff will look nice too.
Yeah.
I don't know any of the other artists that I'm seeing when I look it up, but like, I know the Cassidy stuff will look good.
Yeah. That said, we don't have a book to announce for next week because next week is the second anniversary, and that will basically be us doing the yearly debate over the best writer, best artist, et cetera, of everything we've read in the last year. So, yeah, we have a year's worth of stuff to look back over.
Hell yeah.
Yep. In the meantime, though, I suppose just thank you all for listening, and we'll see you next week. Bye.
Bye.
Be excellent to each other.